We're starting Revelation chapter 18 tonight, and let's begin by reading verses 1 through 3. Brother Dave, could you read that for us? Revelation 18, 1 to 3.
"And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened to his glory. And cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and the home of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have broken the line of the wrath of the fornication. Kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies."
All right, so this is continuing really from where we left off in chapter 17 as far as the subject of Babylon is concerned. Actually, that goes back even before chapter 17. Chapter 16 contained the pouring out of the seven last plagues. And at the end of chapter 16, the Lord pronounced the coming judgment of that city of Babylon that was so wicked. And then we had chapter 17 that described that city and the beast upon which she rode. And it gave a description of those waters that she sat upon, and those kings that were of her, but then also the ones that were not, but that were given their power from the beast that ended up turning on this woman, which is that great city that reigns over the kings of the earth, he says in the last verse of chapter 17. So that's everything has been leading up now to this judgment that is going to be described here in chapter 18. But to understand the judgment, we need to understand the cause. So that's what we've been looking at up to now, what the Lord's been showing us there. And just to repeat that for the purposes of review and to keep us out of trouble, the Lord tells us certain things that these different symbols mean, as he did in chapter 17. But this particular city, well, first of all, is this the actual physical city of Babylon? Babylon didn't exist anymore at that time, nor does it today. It was desolate ruins at that time, and has remained so right to the present. So it was no longer even in existence. Still isn't. So it obviously couldn't be that. So, and why does the Lord keep referring to that as Babylon? I mean, clearly he's using that name in a symbolic fashion, and quotes so many scriptures about that Babylon of old. And we've gone back and looked at a number of those. We have the opportunity to do it here again at the beginning of chapter 18. Because John sees another angel coming down from heaven. I haven't ever attempted to count up the number of angels that John actually sees in this vision in Revelation. But really just about every time we have something else that the Lord is revealing, there's at least another angel involved, if not more. But there have been lots and lots of them here. And once again, as we've called attention to throughout our study of the book, we see John use the phrase, "I saw." This contains the revelation from God to John in a vision. So John is writing what he's seeing and hearing that God is showing to him. Once again, we can ask the question, was this something unusual, how this was going on in the book of Revelation? And when we read it, I mean, there are a lot of unusual things in the book as far as different things that he describes and symbols and all that kind of thing. There's a lot of unique aspects to Revelation for sure, but the way that the Lord was revealing this in a vision to his prophet here, the Apostle John, is that particular pattern there unusual? Or is that the typical pattern that the Lord used to inspire his prophets going back to the beginning? I mean, the Lord spoke to his prophets in visions and dreams, didn't he? And what was he doing with John here? I mean, he was speaking to John in this vision. So this is the Word of God. John's not making this up. So he sees this. He hears this. We have a faithful record of everything that God revealed to him in this. So we just have reminders of that over and over again, just like we see all these different angels that God was using to present this or reveal this to John. So he sees another angel coming down from heaven who has great power. Well, that's important because here this great city that rules over the kings of the earth is going to be destroyed. So an angel's coming here with great power. And the earth was lightened with his glory. So here's one angel that has such glory that it lightens the earth. So is this, if we saw something like that, what would our response be? Yeah. Well, how did Balaam's donkey respond to one angel that was blocking a road with a sword drawn? And that wouldn't have been any... I mean, he was a lot smarter than the rider. true. But here's an angel that comes with great power that lightens the whole earth. I don't think we'd be standing upright if we saw that, do you? But anyway, this is... When we read a description like that, this is would be a magnificent sight. And then he cries mightily with a strong voice. And what does this angel, with this glorious appearance and this great power, with this mighty voice, pronounce there, verse 2? Babylon the great has fallen. Well, that's how it starts. Why that phrase? Well, this is not the first time that phrase has been used in Revelation, is it? Where was the first mention we had of Babylon? It's in the second half of the book of Revelation. It was in chapter 14 and verse 8, where there was another angel in that part of the vision that John saw that said what? Babylon has fallen. So this is a repeat of what Revelation 14, 8 said. But in actuality, that's a repeat of the original pronouncement of destruction upon the literal city of Babylon of old in the book of Isaiah, chapter 21 and verse 9. Let's just read that again. So this is something that we've seen over and over again in Revelation, where God is using something from the Old Testament, and a lot of times with quotations, where he is making a symbol of it for Christians. Of course, the ones that originally received that revelation, but for all others ever since, including us. But Isaiah 21 and verse 9. Let's see, Brother Tom, can you read that one?
And behold, here cometh the chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he hath broken unto the ground.
I mean, is there a connection between this and what he's saying in Revelation? Obviously. He's quoting from this, applying it now in Revelation. So whatever was happening to the original is a symbol, a figure of what this Babylon that we're reading about in Revelation. It's obviously not the same city, because this one, what he pronounced on it here in Isaiah, happened, and it was gone. But do we learn anything from why God destroyed that first one and how severe and utter that destruction was? I mean, that's what he's using as a symbol there. Well, in Isaiah chapter 13, if we can turn there and read verses 21 and 22, when he says what Babylon, what it would be like after it fell. Brother Glenn.
Of all beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of noble creatures, and owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there, and of all beasts of the island shall ride their desolate houses, and attractive in their pleasant places, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged.
All right, so what would happen to Babylon after she fell? Would it be rebuilt? Was there going to be a greater one than the former one? There were some cities that were destroyed in ancient times that were rebuilt. Well, one of them was Jerusalem, was it not? Tyre. I mean, there were some that were destroyed and they were rebuilt, so there was a part two. But what about a Babylon? Was that going to happen? Was Babylon going to be rebuilt? The Lord said it was going to become a place for, he names all those different wild beasts. There'd be no people there. And the Lord was pronouncing a very long destruction. Well, it has endured to the present day. I mean, it's still out in the middle of nowhere in the desert. And it's still just a place of ruins out there. It's not been inhabited by men since that time.
I'm trying to build a Hotel 8 there. Holiday Inn there. Just people died.
Yeah. Yeah, he did have in mind to do that. For if you weren't able to hear, I mean, Saddam Hussein, when he was ruling Iraq, that's where the area where Babylon is, it's now in the country of Iraq, but Saddam wanted to build a Holiday Inn at that place because there's nothing there, and so he was going to make it a tourist spot. But alas, the Lord took him before he was able to do that. It's interesting just to see how enduring that destruction has been. But the Lord was very clear about it. It was going to be destroyed, and it was going to be a wasteland. All right, well, now we're reading about in the New Testament here in Revelation 18 about this Babylon. When he quotes, this angel is giving a quotation from Isaiah 21 that we just read a moment ago, and also as we saw in Revelation 14:8. So again, he's pronouncing the fall of this Babylon, connecting it to the destruction of the original. So from that, can we expect a description of a mighty destruction of this figurative Babylon here? I mean, that makes sense. I mean, based on how he's using the symbol. And then he's describing what dwells in this Babylon. Well, it's not fallen yet. So he's kind of, I mean, it's using some similar type words, but where the first physical Babylon, after its destruction, became a dwelling place of literal wild beasts and all those animals, this Babylon, prior to its fall, is a place full of, well, he's describing. Now, when I was over in India, I had a parrot that reminded me of the last part of verse 2. When it says, a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. And a couple in here met Rita, so you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, but is he talking about, in that description there in verse 2, that this Babylon here is become a habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird? Is he just saying they really had some rotten animals that lived in that city? And what's he referring to there? Yeah, but you know what? Who are the birds? What's the next verse say that we read? If we want to understand that a bit better, what was when it's a dwelling place of all that nasty stuff in verse 2? What's he referring to? What is this city? In this Babylon, it's a city, the one that he's was describing there down through verse 18 of the previous chapter. But what was in this city? I mean, this what was on the forehead of the woman who is the city back in chapter 17, verse 5? Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. I mean, that's what was written on her. And what do we see there in verse 3? All nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. So this Babylon, full of all of this nastiness. It's abomination. Wickedness, sin, and he mentions all these delicacies. It's a blend of all the evil the world has to offer, as well as all of the pleasures, sinful things, but all these delicacies and things. I mean, what a lot of people go to big cities for. I mean, the sin, certainly, but how many people go there to try to get all the fancy, whatever the fancy things that the big city has to offer? You know, they'll have the clothes and the food and all those kinds of things. And how many people go for the delicacies? How many people go for a love of the world? All right, let's see. I'm going to try to use a new thing I've got here that my wife put on my phone program on this. Let's see how it works with that. So this delicacies, it's the Strong's 4764, strainos. That means, that's where our English word strain comes from, or strength. So is that a word describing things that are inherently sinful? What if they grew rich through the abundance of her delicacies? So on the one hand, we saw the abominations, the sin, the fornication, and some of that could be spiritual. I mean, idolatry. I mean, there's false religion. But then on the other side here, you've got the wealth, the delicacies. Are all things of the world sinful? No, they're not. A lot of things are. What are the things of the world, according to 1 John? Let's go back to 1 John 2. And read verses 15 to 17. 1 John 2, 15 to 17. Samuel, you got that one? So he tells us not to love the world, neither the things that are in the world. What are the things of the world? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So what the flesh desires, what the eyes desire, and then what's going to feed pride, those are the things of the world. Now, does the flesh and do the eyes only desire sinful things? I mean, all right, in Matthew chapter 6, starting in verse 24 is part of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6, 24. How similar is that to 1 John 2:15? 1 John 2:15 that says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in it. How similar is that to Matthew 6, 24 when he says, no man can serve two masters? For either he will love the one and hate the other, else he will hold the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. What is mammon? Material things. Are material things automatically or inherently sinful? What is the root of all evil? The love of what? Money. Is money inherently sinful? Now, the love of it is the root of all evil. So desiring money is good or bad? Covetousness is bad. It's a sin. All right. Well, would the Lord command us every first day of the week to put in here something that's inherently sinful? No, obviously. He tells us how to use that. We're not to love it. We're not to covet it. But what the Lord gives us, we are to use to serve Him. So there's a right way to use that. So the love of money is the root of all evil. But if, as a Christian, we have the proper understanding and the right heart, we'll take whatever the Lord gives us and we're going to serve Him with it. Well, that which is our own, as well as that which goes to Him, which is laid by in store. So we need to use everything for the Lord's purpose to fulfill His will. If we do that, then we're pleasing God and doing what He tells us to do. Is it a sin to eat food? Is it a sin to drink? Is it a sin to have clothing, shelter, rest? I mean, those are necessities of life. In Matthew 6, right after verse 24, when he says we cannot serve God and material things, what are the examples that he gives? What's the application that comes right after that? All right, Brother Travis, can you read Matthew 6? Go ahead and do the 24 to 34. So what's the application of you cannot serve God and material things? Now, a lot of people would like for him to have made application of all kinds of sinful activities with material. But that's not what he did right there, is it? He used what we call the necessities of life, things we have to have to live, food, drink, and clothes, as examples of that we can't serve God and those things. Now, what does he say about the Gentiles, the nations, in verse 32? I mean, do we see magazines and things, whatever, in the world for food? You know, do they have things like that just devoted to all the finest foods and the finest clothes and all that? I mean, that, and how much of advertising is whatever is geared towards that stuff? It's really amazing how much the devil accomplishes through getting people to seek after things that aren't inherently sinful. Because we might think of his work being concentrated on getting people to get wrapped up in sin, which is certainly a big part of what he does. But how many people does he get wrapped up and entangled just in a love with the world? He tells us not to take thought for those things. Now, that there's a form of that exact same word there that is translated care in Luke 8:14 when he's teaching the parable of the sower and the thorny ground. Brother Michael, can you read Luke 8:14?
That was so among the thorns of Abel when they have heard, go forth and show the cares, the riches, the pleasures of this life, and bring no fruit to perfection.
All right, cares and riches and pleasures of this life. I mean, the pleasures certainly can include sinful things, but not necessarily. The thought that those cares, that's a form of the exact same word that's in Matthew 6 that we were just reading, where he said, take no thought for it, when he was applying it to food, drink, and clothes. That's obviously not inherently sinful, those things. The point is, by seeking after and loving material things, even though it may be money, it may be food, drink, and clothes, those things that are not of themselves sinful, if we love those things, are we going to be able to have the love of the Father in us? Can we serve God in those things? Are we going to be able to bring fruit to perfection for God if we are, if we've got all those thorns choking us? No. So when we're seeing here in Revelation 18, when he's describing that city and all that it has to offer, is there wickedness there? There's vile wickedness there. But what else is there? All the riches, the pleasures, the delicacies, everything. So it's an attraction for everybody, really, isn't it? Because even people that might, I don't want to get off into those sinful things over there, but they sure might get into all the riches and the delicacies and all of that. The devil, he'll try every way to get us. If he can wrap us up in this world, whether it's in sin or whether it's just a love of money and the things that our eyes and flesh desire that may not even be sinful in and of themselves, but if he can get us where that's our life, that's what we love, that's what we care about, that's what we're seeking, and we're not going to be able to serve God and love him that way. However he can get us, is he happy to have us? Do you really think he's particular about which particular dart he's able to get us with? Which variety of snare that he's able to capture us with? One guy might be one thing, but somebody else, it's a different thing. But, I mean, how many different ways does the devil have to try to get us away from loving and serving God? Is he really going to be, do you think he really cares in the end which of those things we fall for? With him, the point is for us to be deceived and not love and serve God. So here's this big city. It's got it all. And everybody's going after it. Everybody, how much influence is from this city? It's the source of all of this. So everybody's wrapped up in it. Everybody's affected. All right, but what about God's people? Well, that's who he addresses there in verse 4. Because we have a little bit further down in verse 18, after she's destroyed all these merchants of the earth, they're going to be crying because of all the stuff that's gone, forever gone, when they lose all those material things. Which gives us an opportunity to think about, if what we love in this life, if it's money, if it's material things, whatever that is, some of you young folks back there, if you retire from life, the world's greatest champion, Minecraft or what are those things called? I hear the name sometimes, Pokemon, all that kind of thing. You finish this life and you're the best that there ever was at that. And then you leave this life, then what? I mean, there's not going to be a place for that there, is there? He describes the merchants of the earth with all that they do, with all their commerce and all the material things they get from it, and then the city's gone, all that stuff's gone, and they're lamenting over it because it's all gone forever. Whatever it is, if we're wrapped up in this world, what was that part of verse 17 about those things of the world, of 1 John 2 that we read? We didn't just read 15 and 16, but what does it say about those things in verse 17. He that loves God abides forever. But what about those lusts of the flesh, the lusts of the eyes, and the pride of life? They pass away. This world passes away and all that's in it. If that's what we love, then we enter eternity with our heart formed to love things that are gone for that eternity. If that's what our heart is formed in loving, what we're trained in now through this life, and we leave here, what do we have for eternity? Nothing. What a tragedy that everything you loved is gone for the rest of eternity, and you'll never have it again. If we love God, and we do what He says in 1 Timothy 6:11, flee these a love of these things, and follow after righteousness and godliness and faith and meekness and all of those things, patience, if that's what we love, then when we leave this life, what do we got? Does that get left behind? Do we enter an eternity where all those things are gone forever? Or do we enter an eternity continuing on with all the things that we loved here, we still got there? But that's why we have to, or somebody said, well, no, I'd rather, all right, I want to love the world here, but then I'll get me over there and I'll learn to love the other things then. That's not what's going to happen. That's not the way it works. So when is our opportunity to have our hearts trained in what we love to love the right things, the good things, right now? And this is a reminder of that. This chapter is one of the best reminders of that point that we could ever have. So he addresses God's people in verse 4. Because is it possible that for any of us to be affected or influenced by this world? And really, with this Babylon, this is a figurative city. I mean, it's obviously he's using here a city that rules over the kings of the earth. It's a dominant place that's influence is felt far and wide everywhere. And there are a lot of people that like to try to say, well, that's Rome. And again, we'll say, could Rome fit that description? There are a lot of things about Rome that would fit that description. He doesn't say that is Rome. If it could include that, fine, if that's what the Lord intended. But does it have to be just one place in time? I mean, what is he really warning us against here? I mean, what is he talking? If this is the world, and in our own time, I mean, if you think about it, if he said this was just one city for one moment in time and that's it, well, then that's destroyed, it's gone. Really, what relevance does that have for us then? Not a lot. Maybe we just, okay, well, we don't want to be like that. But, I mean, when he's teaching us, here's what this world does. Here's what it offers. Here's what people get caught up in. And then he says, now you... Here's another voice coming from heaven. He's going to address my people. So here's the Lord speaking. Okay, my people. Here's all this. Here's all this in this city, in this world. My people, what do we do about it? Because look at our own time. What's going on in our world today? I mean, is there anything about what we're reading here that fits what we're facing today in a spiritual sense? I mean, look at what this world is doing, and we have so much. I mean, it almost in the way the modern world is, it almost doesn't have to be one place, because there really is just one place, in the sense that, I mean, everybody's got a phone, you got the world coming through. It's all over. I mean, how do we get away from it? The influence, the devil's got this stuff coming at us all the time. It's just, he's bombarding us with this, and it's this message that he has there in verse 4, it's as relevant today as it ever was for God's people. We need to listen to that. So what does he say there in verse 4? Let's go ahead and read that. Brother Johnson, can you read 4 and 5 there?
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partaker of her sins, and that you receive not her plagues. Her sins have reached unto heaven. God hath remembered her iniquities.
All right. So what does God say to his people in all this? Does he have any people in a world like this that he's describing? In spite of it all, he has some people there. A lot or few? Few. There are echoes of what place, when you read those verses in 4 and 5, I mean, does it remind you of any other wicked place? What comes to your mind? What's that?
2 Corinthians.
Well, that scripture, and that's the one I got here for in my notes. But as far as a place when he says, get out of her so you don't get zapped by her plagues. Does that remind anybody of what when he sent the angel and told Lot to get his family out of Sodom and Gomorrah? Get out for that so that he wasn't affected by that. What was going to happen? He wouldn't. Well, there was, I mean, there's just another, and we talked about it. I mean, does God speak well of big cities in the scriptures? They don't have a good track record at all. Whenever you get a lot of people together, what do they tend to use their imaginations for? And one guy with one imagination for wickedness in one remote location, how much damage can he do? Well, a lot nowadays, because we can just plug it into the internet. But before that, I mean, it would be hard for one guy to do a lot, right? But you get a few million together, and they blend all that together, put their minds together, and can the imaginations of their heart tend to only wickedness? I mean, that happens. That's why it becomes such a source of all of that. And it's always been that way. But Lot, and does anybody remember in 2 Peter 2, how did Lot feel about where the places where he was, where he lived? It says it vexed his righteous soul from day to day. Having been around that, I mean, it disgusted him. I mean, he was vexed by it daily. He was one that did not get caught up in it. But of all of his family, how many were vexed by that wickedness like he was? I mean, his wife made it out just very briefly, but she looked back, broke the commandment. Because that's why in the New Testament, Luke 17, he says, remember Lot's wife. No man putting his hand to the plow is fit for the kingdom of God if we look back. If we're looking back to that world that we came out of, that he's called us out of, and that's what we love, well, I sure missed that. If that's what we're thinking, we got the wrong heart. We're not fit for serving God if our hearts, if our affection is here. I mean, how can we have our affection on the things above and also on the things of the earth? It doesn't work. So, Lot was vexed, but his wife obviously cared for those places. I mean, why did he think he lived there? Because that's where he wanted to be? And then his other children, they mocked when he told them to get out. He got his two youngest daughters out, but they became the mothers of Moab and Ammon, those nations. Is that good? No. So it's really sad what happened to his family. But they were corrupted by where they were. Lot wasn't, though. But he was told to get out. He did. And so the Lord spared him from those plagues. So it's hard not to be reminded of that episode with the words there in verses 4 and 5. But Brother Johnson's right. I mean, when we see what he says to his people, come out of her. Don't be a partaker of her sins. That's very much like we're involved in a multi-lesson study based in that when we were looking at perfecting holiness, which is in verse 1 of 2 Corinthians 7, which just continues on from that passage starting in 2 Corinthians 6:14. How much damage would it do us to read that again? Let's go there. 2 Corinthians 6. Let's see, Brother Trey, can you read 2 Corinthians 6? You got something to tap on or turn? You going old-fashioned on me, or you got something electronic? 14. Down through chapter 7, verse 1. Thank you. That sounds very similar to what we read there, what God speaks to his people regarding this time with that wicked city. His people, he says, come out of her. Now, are there some places in this world that we as Christians, it'd just be best for us not to be there? I can think of several locations that I'm very happy is not where I live, and I would not consider it very good for me to live there. I mean, how easy was it for Lot to raise a family and keep them unspotted from the world in where he lived? I mean, we can mention this because glad we got the young folks in here tonight. Because when it comes time to deciding things like, well, if you want to go off to school somewhere, you know, a lot of people when they're choosing, well, where am I going to go to college? Or something like that. Or if it's just for some job opportunity. But there are a lot of, what is the number one, if we're looking at the world, what is the number one criteria for deciding where to go? Yeah, and ultimately towards salary. What's going to be able to advance your career, which is all about what's going to end up getting you the most money. I mean, that's really what it's geared towards. And someone who is successful, as the world uses that term, is somebody who's achieved that. They've done very well in that. They have advanced very high, and they got a big salary. They got a job that gives them a big salary, and they got a lot of money. Well, there's going to be, if that's how the world decides, well, they're going to go to this place because this will be a good opportunity for them for this career to be able to do that. And it's going to be geared strictly towards worldly concerns. Is that the way Christians should be thinking? Is that the basis? Should that be the basis of our decisions? See, that's what this is about, this kind of thing. I mean, what do we value? I mean, do we love the world or do we love the Lord? And if we love the Lord, our priority system is going to be completely different. When we're deciding where to go or what to do, what's it going to be based in? What's the best way I can serve the Lord? There's some careers that should just, you can't be a Christian and be involved. I remember when I was, I'm not calling any names, nobody here, but I mean, when I was, I remember back at, when I was in high school and college and here in this town, and one of the members of the church where I was at the time, I mean, drove a beer truck. I mean, what? I had a problem with that then. I still have a problem with that. I mean, that's just, how can a Christian be doing that? How can I go bring that product to somebody? And in some, I know I'm kind of, maybe I'm starting to meddle and quit preaching, but but think about these are things where we have scriptures that teach us about the right and wrong of it. If it's not good for somebody to do, should we be selling it? Should we be helping them to get it? I mean, even working in a grocery store, if you're just working a regular checkout line, I mean, you're going to be helping people to buy their liquor and all that kind of stuff and the beer and everything. Working in the convenience store, there's just some things we just better off not being involved in. And, I mean, we need to think about our priorities, what we decide to do should be as a Christian. How can I serve the Lord the best? Is that going to do it? Or do we need to try to look for something that's, okay, here's something I can do that's going to be useful in this world in a good sense. I can do something good for people and make an honest living and then look to be in a place where I'm not going to be surrounded by, of course, we're in the world. And when he says come out, does he mean for us to physically remove ourselves from the world? We're to be in it, but not of it. But when we're in it, there's still some places it's just best not to be in. Look at Sodom and Gomorrah, or what this place that he's describing there. So, I mean, there are obviously some places worse than others. And you young folks, when you're making decisions about where to go, you should be thinking about, well, how can I best serve the Lord? Some people end up getting in places And there are no Christians there. There's no congregation where you've got faithful members of the Lord's body, and then they get stuck there. And how good a situation is that spiritually? So those are all things that we need to think about. Okay, what's best for my service to the Lord, me and my family? And even if you're single, I mean, what's going to happen? You're going to meet somebody in one of those places. And what happened in Genesis 6 when the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair? And they married them, and then that was the end of the godly seed on earth. So that'll happen too. So we got to think, we have all these different scriptures that teach us about these different kinds of things like this. We need to remember what the Lord says here. As far as this world, I mean, what fellowship or what involvement, what kinship, friendship do we have with that? We shouldn't be. We need to be holy to God. That's why he finishes that up. How holy should we be? Perfecting, completing holiness. We need to be completely holy. How much of uncleanness do we need to purge out? All of it. In the fear of God, and we went through all that in that study. I mean, we got to have a hatred of evil and a love for what's good and righteous, to want to see that good and do that good and put away that evil. That's got to be our... If that's what our mind is, Lord's going to work on our heart to make us where then we are completely set apart for Him, where all we are doing is pleasing Him, where we have fully come out from this world. That's what He calls us to do. Well, how similar is that passage in 2 Corinthians to this one? My people, come out from her, of her. Be not partakers of her sins, that you receive not of her plagues. Now, if we're in the world and we're supposed to be the salt of the earth. We're in it, we're not to be of it, but we're supposed to be influencing the world so that they can see our good works and glorify God. If we are influenced by the world and become like the world, well, then we've lost our savor, right? Our flavor, salt. What good are we then to God in this world? And that's what happens if we become partakers of these things and we're of the world while we're in it. Are we going to then escape the destruction that will come upon the wicked because we once were following the Lord on that straight and narrow road that leads to life eternal? If we depart from that and get on the broad road that leads to destruction, the fact that we once were there, is that going to save it? In fact, what's the actual truth of it? Knowing what we know, and if we leave it, our plague will be worse, won't it? We'll have many stripes. Did I make that up, or is that in Luke 12? That is in Luke 12, 47 and 48. Brother Stephen, can you read Luke 12, 47 and 48? Luke 12, 47 and 48. So if we turn away from what we know and we go back into the world, are we going to be punished more severely for that? The Lord's going to require of us more. He expects more of us. He has a higher standard for us because we know better. Do we like being held to a high standard? We should. I mean, what's a higher standard than the mark of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus, or the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ? He's given us the highest of standards to aim for. And it's not to go back into this world. That shouldn't bother us, that warning, but we should be aware of it, make sure we don't do that, but we need to press towards that mark of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. But we got to come out from this wicked world. The whole world lies in wickedness, 1 John 5:19. That's what we're reading about here. And so we've got to come out from all of that. But how much wickedness is in the world? And how much just love of worldly material things and all of that? Well, we're going to have a lot more detail about it. In verse 5, it says, "Our sins have reached unto heaven, and God has remembered our iniquities." That's almost an exact quote from the description of Sodom and Gomorrah before the destruction of those places in Genesis. We see references really in the language here to lots of similar places to what he's describing there that are fitting symbols of the wickedness of this world. All right, and then God's going to bring his punishment upon this place. And how extensive is it going to be? Well, here we get to verse 6. Let's see. But Arthur, can you read Revelation 18 and verse 6?
"Reward her even as she rewarded you, and thou unto her, double unto her, double according to her works, in the cup which she has filled to her double."
All right, so God is going to reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her, double according to her works. Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it, for this place? How does God determine the proper amount of punishment that a person or a group of people is worthy of? It is according to the works, and God's always going to judge that way. And we have reminders of that going back to the very beginning. In Genesis 15, when he gave that vision to appeared to Abraham, and a horror of darkness fell upon him. What was dark about what Abram, as he was known at the time, what he saw there? Well, God had promised to bless him with a son, and then he was going to make from that son a great nation, and he was going to give them that land that he lived in there in Canaan for the inheritance for that nation. He was going to end up bringing his son as Abraham's seed through that nation. All of those were very positive blessings. But then God revealed some other details to Abram that were very dark for him to come to know, and what was going to happen to those descendants of his. 400 years of slavery. After that, they were going to be given that land. God was going to judge the nation that enslaved them. And of course, that was Egypt. He didn't name Egypt by name there, but that's who it turned out to be, as we know. But then he gave a reason. And I said, why did he have to hold? Why didn't, as soon as their number grew great enough, which was long before 400 years, why didn't God just immediately, once their numbers were fulfilled, that part of his promise, as far as the numerical part, that they could be a nation for that land, why didn't he immediately then get them into Canaan? There was a reason. The wickedness of the Amorites was not yet full. Why did that matter? Because what was the sentence God was going to pronounce upon them for Israel to be able to take all of that land there? Was it going to work for Abraham's descendants to be there in the midst of all those others, those Amorites, those Canaanite nations? No. And in Deuteronomy 7, what was the sentence that he put upon them? It was utter destruction. It was a death sentence for all of those nations. That was the punishment. Well, in order for God to give that judgment, that punishment to those nations, what level of wickedness had to be there? Yeah, so the wickedness had to be full. So were they wicked at the time that God was speaking to Abram? There was wickedness, definitely. But are there degrees of wickedness? There are. And the trajectory on that they were on was downhill, as far as that's concerned. They were getting more and more wicked. But there was a point at which God would be able to see where their wickedness was full. And that's a term that he uses in the New Testament when he puts his enemies under his feet. When I look at this world, or when you look at this world, I mean, how wicked does it look to you and me? It looks awful. It looks very wicked. To me, I would think it's just about fully wicked, but what do I know? I can't see anything like God can. I mean, how wicked did the world look 30 years ago, or 40 or 50 years ago? And some of you remember that well then. Has it changed? It didn't look so good then, but now look at it. What's it going to look like if the Lord gives, if it stays on the same trajectory, what are things going to look like in another 50 years? Yeah, and then we'll have whatever we got coming up now. And I mean, but do you or I know when can we say, okay, now that wickedness is full? The Lord can see that. And that's why, who does vengeance belong to? It belongs to the Lord. He knows the hearts of all men. And He knows exactly what punishment every individual is worthy of. And so He's the one, and only He is the one, qualified to be able to make those decisions, which is really what the word judgment is, to be able to render judgment like that. I mean, how could I properly dispense judgment when I can't see those things like God can see? I mean, none of us can. And so that belongs to God. But when you have wickedness on this level, is the punishment going to fit that level of wickedness? Yeah, when God says she's going to get double for this, she was worthy of it, is the point. And so she was worthy of this judgment of the Lord, severe as it is, and God was going to do that. A lesson for everybody, because God's going to judge all wickedness in the end. Nobody's going to get away with anything. No matter how bad it looks, or no matter how outnumbered we are, as far as this world is concerned, God is still the one in control of it all, and He's going to be the one to judge everyone in the end. Sometimes He does things in this life too, but we have many examples of that. But I mean, the real punishment is going to be that eternal one, and we obviously don't want to be partaking of those plagues. So we better come out from this world. We better keep ourselves unspotted from the world. What's pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father in James 1:27? To visit the widows and fatherless in their affliction, to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. I hear the first part of that quoted a lot more than I hear the very end of that. And it's true. We've got to do the compassionate works on those that are in need. It's also true that we have a great responsibility to keep ourselves unspotted from this world. We can't go to the judgment covered in this world's spots and have things go well for us there. So that's our task as part of pure religion and undefiled before God. All right, we're going to stop here. We're already a couple minutes over, but we'll pick it up there, Lord willing, next Wednesday night.